The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. And we'll start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline, Special Report, Healthcare Heroes Awards. And the articles actually start inside the Triangle Business Journal, beginning with the Lifetime Achievement Award for the 2019 Healthcare Heroes Awards winners. And the Lifetime Achievement Award is for William Roper, the University of North Carolina System, age 70, family members, wife Marianne, education MD, University of Alabama, MPH, University of Alabama, Birmingham. In reflecting on the course of his career, Dr. William Roper readily describes his path as atypical. Over the course of more than 40 years, that path has taken him from the executive boardrooms of healthcare giants and regulatory agencies to the head of healthcare systems and centers of education. A graduate of the University of Alabama School of Medicine and University of Alabama at Birmingham School of Public Health, Roper completed his residency in pediatrics at the University of Colorado Medical Center. In the years since, Roper has served as a White House Fellow, the Administrator of the Healthcare Financing Administration, the Director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and even as Senior White House Staff. In 1993, he joined Prudential as President of the Prudential Center for Healthcare Research, and eventually served as Senior Vice President of the company. Roper made his debut at UNC Chapel Hill in 1997 as the Dean of the School of Public Health. He went on to serve as Dean of the School of Medicine and Vice Chancellor for Medical Affairs at the UNC Chapel Hill and CEO of the UNC Healthcare System. All the while, Roper continued to serve as a Professor of Health Policy and Management in the School of Public Health and a Professor of Pediatrics and Social Medicine in the School of Medicine at the University. Roper says that his entry into a life of such variety came from the recommendation of others and from a driving desire to serve those around him. He says that variety has given him the opportunity of not only helping directly through medicine, but by addressing the industry from an array of positions. The notion of blending those leadership, service, medicine has been a happy combination in my career thus far, he says. That career, Roper says, is still far from over. Though previously he announced his intention to retire, the early resignation of UNC System President Margaret Spellings has led to him to accept yet another role as the interim president of state's public universities. Roper says he sees the role as just another position in a long line of opportunities that have presented themselves in his life, opportunities for him to continue taking the mantle on others' behalf. What motivates me is a desire to be of service, he says. I hope in retrospect someone will say that I've been a servant leader. What motivates you in your everyday work? A desire to serve and to make the world a better place, especially for those at the margins of society. What are your chief responsibilities? Interim president of North Carolina's public four-year and graduate and professional university system. What do you enjoy most about what you do? Getting to work with very smart, dedicated, and committed public servants in service to the people of North Carolina, doing extremely consequential things. What do you consider to be some of your major accomplishments? Expanding the reach and impact of UNC Healthcare across North Carolina and positioning it as North Carolina's healthcare system. How does your work impact patients and others in the healthcare community? Providing quality, innovative care to all without regard to ability to pay. If you could change one thing about healthcare, what would it be? Actually lower the cost of care. Why did you choose healthcare for a career? I wanted to serve people and to do something science-based. What do you like most about living in the Triangle? The feel of a smaller town with big city amenities plus Carolina basketball. What do you do to relax and have fun? Walking my dog Buddy every morning. He gives me my best advice. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. ACC tournament is back in NC and plans to return. The Atlantic Coast Conference men's basketball tournament is back in North Carolina. Whew! And it looks like the tournament will be coming back to the state on a regular basis in the years ahead. The 2019 event is Charlotte for the first time in 11 years and then goes to Greensboro in 2020. After that, it's in Washington, D.C. in 2021, take that Terps, and Brooklyn, New York in 2022. The ACC's push to play its signature event in other markets hasn't always worked out. For example, trips to Tampa in 2007 and Atlanta in 2009 and 2012 didn't generate enormous buzz for the event. Tampa is on the far edge of the ACC footprint, making it a plane flight for most fans, and the ACC and Georgia Tech are only one piece of a large Atlanta sports scene. I think that rotation of Charlotte, Greensboro, Washington, and New York worked well, and this, in a sense, is a continuation of that. We haven't gone beyond 2022 yet, John Swafford told Charlotte Business Journal this week. Through 2015, the tournament had only been held outside North Carolina 11 times since it started in 1954. Charlotte is hosting for the 13th time, and Swafford suggested it won't be long before the tournament returns. A rotation like this one fits the bill, Swafford said. When you look at it from that perspective, something similar to this going forward is probable. In Charlotte's favor is the fact that it has a thriving downtown scene and a heavy presence from the ACC's television partner, ESPN. That relationship will only grow when ESPN launches the ACC network later this year. Beer Distribution Center in Raleigh sold for a big price. One of the largest beer and wine distributors in North Carolina now owns a prominent Raleigh distribution center. R.H. Behringer of Greensboro has purchased the R.A. Jeffries Distribution Center at 420 Civic Boulevard in Raleigh for $13 million. R.A. Jeffries Distributing, in business since 1923, has sold its other properties to Charlotte's Adams Beverages of NC and Rocky Mount's Carolina Eagle Distributing. Jeffries, which was based in Goldsboro, served 36 counties from Raleigh to Wilmington, delivering premium, craft, import, and specialty beers. Behringer is now the state's largest wholesaler. Tim Kent, executive director of the North Carolina Beer and Wine Wholesalers Association, says the Raleigh warehouse is a state-of-the-art facility. Kent says Robert Jeffries and his two sisters just decided it was time to sell, and they wanted to sell to distributors owned by North Carolina families. Here's why Carrboro is an epicenter of something you didn't expect, art. A Carrboro company that's a go-to firm for art has a new acquisition, and it's not something you hang on your wall. Kalisher, spelled K-A-L-I-S-H-E-R, begun by the husband and wife team of Jesse and Helen Kalisher, is acquiring Soho Marriott Fine Art of Atlanta. Kalisher, established in 2004, curates and provides art for the commercial hospitality industry and uses more than 100 artists and creative professionals. Soho Marriott Fine Art has created custom art packages for high-end business projects in the hospitality, commercial, and even cruise line industries since 1995. Jesse Kalisher died of cancer in July 2017. Kalisher President David Winton will be the CEO and president of the companies, which will retain their individual brands. This is an extraordinary opportunity to now partner and collaborate with the immense talent and experience of Soho Marriott, Winton says. It's a cool move for Carrboro, a once-overlooked part of the Triangle that has exploded into a vibrant community with a booming restaurant and brewery scene and a haven for art, too. Shaw Beer, Bear, B-E-A-R, ready to take a shot at the NBA draft. With all the hype surrounding college basketball in the Triangle, it's rare to have a local NBA draft prospect with such high projections come from a school not named UNC Chapel Hill, Duke University, or NC State University. The prospect in question is Shaw University star Amir Hinton. On March 7, the junior guard announced he's declaring for the NBA draft. He's projected by ESPN as the 49th overall pick. Hinton is hoping to become the first Division II player to be drafted since 2005. "I think the timing is perfect for me," Hinton told ESPN. "I will be hiring an agent. I am ready. I'm going to try and be a lottery pick." Shaw University saw its season end March 2 when it lost to Virginia State in the CIAA Tournament Championship game. Dollars didn't matter. NC gets picked over New Jersey. Here at Biz, we're bullish on North Carolina overall and the Triangle in general, but we realize dollars matter when companies make decisions. So it was refreshing to hear Dr. Andre Chaluka, CEO of the French gene editing company Selectus, say his company picked Raleigh for its deep talent pool and thriving biopharmaceutical industry. The firm named Raleigh as the home of its first North American manufacturing plant. The project means 200 jobs for the region, which will average $100,823. The decision came down to Raleigh or New Jersey, and Selectus didn't pick the City of Oaks because the barbecue is better. "The attraction is essentially the ability to attract talent," he says. New Jersey offered an $8 million incentive package, more than North Carolina's $2 million grant. But Chaluka says the company was not just hunting for incentives. So to New Jersey, Biz says, sorry, you guys. And to Selectus, bienvenue. And finally, now you can name the NC Aquarium's newest eagles. When naming two of its newest residents, North Carolina Aquariums will get a little help from technology. The North Carolina Aquarium at Pine Knoll Shores is now caring for two female bald eagles and is asking the public to vote for potential names on Facebook. Voting ends March 15 at midnight. The names the public can vote on are Native American. The bald eagles were injured prior to coming to the aquarium. One flew into a power line and the other was found with an injury. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the page written by Lauren Onosorge on finance, startups, and transportation. JP Morgan Chase details plans for the Triangle. Months after local branch plans were first disclosed through regulatory filings, officials at New York banking giant JP Morgan Chase are ready to detail their Triangle build-out, part of a major expansion into 9 new U.S. markets. Brent Gore, who oversees the bank's middle market banking business in the Carolinas, says the new branches planned for Raleigh and Chapel Hill are part of a broader strategy to be in all the top markets across the country. The Chapel Hill location at Carolina Square on Franklin Street opens in mid-late summer, with the Raleigh location, located just off Wake Forest Road, opening in late 2019. Gore says J.P. Morgan enters the local market with a big advantage, an existing Raleigh customer base. According to a bank spokesman, it already serves more than 272,000 local consumers through services such as credit cards and mortgages. J.P. Morgan already works with 7,900 small businesses in Raleigh, a number it hopes will expand rapidly. It plans to expand its headcount, too. The bank is looking for a Raleigh market leader for the new consumer-focused operation, Gore says. It's also evaluating options for branch managers. It's too early to name our leaders in the Raleigh market, he says. But leadership roles are just one piece of J.P. Morgan's hiring plans. Gore says to expect an aggressive recruitment process in the next few months as the bank prepares to launch its consumer business locally. The bank plans to start its entry-level employees in Raleigh at no less than $14 per hour. They'll also receive the firm's full benefits package, valued at an average $12,000 annually per employee in that pay range, according to the company. South Carolina-based bank to invest in Triangle branches. An out-of-state bank holding company has disclosed aggressive plans to increase its presence in the Triangle. 7 years after Charlotte's Park Sterling entered the Triangle with a loan production office, its new parent company, South Carolina-based South State Bank, wants to bring two new retail locations to Raleigh. It has 8 branches in Richmond, Virginia, and 17 in Charlotte. That makes Raleigh the glaring hole, says Brian Kennedy, division president of North Carolina and Virginia. That changes March 25 when a branch at 6623 Falls of Neuse Road opens. The second branch, planned for the Glenwood Corridor, should open this fall, he adds. It's an intentional strategy for us to focus on building the Raleigh retail presence, Kennedy says. Raleigh is a big market that's hard to cover from one location. The bank intends to aggressively build branches, assuming we can find the right location and financial model, he says. Kennedy says he expects the Raleigh branches to be profitable within 3 to 5 years, which he says is typical. And he says the existing operation will help build the customer base. I think it really starts with our commercial and private banking team, Kennedy says. We continue to build up a nice book of customers in Raleigh. He says South State plans to grow its Raleigh team in the coming months. Ben Collier, Raleigh Regional Senior Vice President, says South State fits a niche that's needed in the Triangle. We're in the sweet spot between the big bank and the small bank, he says. Bank Street Partners founder Lee Burrows calls South State a remarkably well-run bank that compares to Pinnacle Financial Partners and United Community Banks. Growth-oriented banks see the Triangle as a very attractive banking market, he says. I see this as a natural extension of a growing and thriving bank. Tech entrepreneur to campaign for cancer screenings. When something like this happens to you, you just want to have something good come out of it. I want to use my platform so that the news is not really about me per se and this challenge I have in front of me, but more about what can other people do to learn from it, said Brooks Bell shortly after stepping down as CEO of the Raleigh marketing company that bears her name, Brooks Bell. Facing a stage 3 colon cancer diagnosis, she's transitioning to an executive chairwoman position and starting a campaign to educate young people on the importance of colon cancer screenings. The campaign, called 50 Colonoscopies Under 50, aims to celebrate young people who have gotten cancer screenings, as well as to challenge stigmas associated with the procedure. Entrepreneur tries to change the way liquor is made. A next-generation liquor startup from Raleigh is taking its spirits abroad. Next Century Spirits, a firm recently spun out of Anavo Technologies, via a $3.6 million investment, is debuting its technology this month at the 2019 International Bulk Wine and Spirits Show. Founder Scott Bolin, formerly of diaper technology firm Tethys, says the concept is the biggest innovation. That could give investors such as Chapel Hill's Blue Hill Group a big return. The process cuts the time needed to create the spirits, think hours instead of years. Within a year, the 15-person firm has scaled its Durham production facility to 1,000 proof gallons per day. With typical spirits, Bolin says, you need to have wood flavor, the chemicals from wood in your product to make it taste good. Traditionally, that's done by putting the product in a barrel for a long period of time and hoping you get the compounds you want and not the ones you don't want, he adds. You don't want swampy flavors, you want good flavors. Next Century Spirits skips that process. It has identified the wood compounds you really want and can extract those chemicals and add them to the alcohol. And finally, in a section called He Said It, the quote, the one question I would ask here is, there's 5,000 acres worth of property that's been slated for recreational use here in our community, and our 105 acres seems to be the only acreage we're using for single-track off-road biking. Well, why is that? And that's from Mike Languth, CEO of Raleigh-Durham Airport Authority, reacting to criticism from the cycling community about RDU's decision to lease the 105-acre tract to Wakestone Corporation. Cyclists use trails on the track, but illegally, and RDU has never authorized the use of that land for recreation. Now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Life Sciences page, written by Seth Thomas Gulledge. Partnership allows for more power for change. Executives from Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina and Cambia Health Solutions say their new partnership is about the potential that comes from combining two massive insurers' revenue and customer base and bargaining power, not necessity. On March 12, the companies announced a strategic affiliation, consolidating management, administrative, operational, and other corporate services under a Cambia-named roof, while maintaining two independent companies of the original name. Dr. Patrick Conway, the CEO of BCBSNC, will serve as CEO of the new entity, and Cambia CEO Mark Gans will serve as executive chair. They say the move is about combining power, not shedding weight. We didn't do this for some headcount or other reason. We actually think this will position us to grow for the future, Conway says. To be a vibrant company and culture that delivers better, simpler, and more effective care for the people that we serve. Conway says that by sharing resources and strategic visions, the companies can pass savings and increase quality on to patients. Working together, we will adopt and build on what each of us does best, he says. For example, Cambia is a leader in improving consumer experiences through innovation. Blue Cross NC is a leader in advancing value-based care. By sharing resources, innovation, and best-in-class abilities, this affiliation will enable both companies to offer individuals and families better, simpler, and more affordable care. What is unclear are the specific ways these entities would save dollars. Conway and Gans, whose company is based in Portland, Oregon, say the power of the partnership would come from the size and influence in the marketplace. Last year, Cambia reported revenue of about $6 billion from coverage of around 2.6 million people. In the same year, BCBSNC reported about $9.9 billion from coverage of 3.7 million. Together, the companies will be managing more than 6 million customers, bringing in over $15 billion in revenue. In 2018, Blue Cross's net income topped $684 million. Gann says the overall goal is the same, to increase the value and lower the cost for patients. We think that coming together on our own, we can move faster to achieve it because we can bring more force, he says. Conway and Gans pointed to Blue Premier, a recently launched Blue Cross NC plan that focuses on value-based care as an initiative that could be implemented in the now shared markets on the West Coast. UNC Rex receives national recognition for heart care. Just 2 years after launching its heart hospital, UNC Rex is receiving national recognition for cardiovascular care, recognition not shared anywhere else in the state. The hospital recently received the American College of Cardiology's Heart Care Center National Distinction of Excellence, which was awarded to just 13 hospitals nationwide. Rex is the only hospital in North Carolina to receive the designation. Its North Carolina Heart and Vascular Hospital first opened in 2017 and has since treated thousands of patients. In November, the hospital was ranked along with Duke Regional Hospital as one of the top 50 cardiovascular hospitals in the country by IBM's Watson Health. Why the Triangle is ranked among the top 5 life sciences hubs. A new ranking of the life sciences hubs has the Triangle in the top 5 in the nation, thanks to its exploding growth and deep talent pool. A recent report from commercial real estate services and investment firm CBRE put the Triangle at 5th overall. The list was led by Boston and the San Francisco Bay Area. The CBRE analysis looked at 4 main criteria: the number of scientists in key categories, funding for local companies, size and long-term growth of their life sciences workforce, and their inventory of lab space. The report cites initiatives North Carolina policymakers undertook decades ago and the creation of Research Triangle Park in 1959 as keys to the growth. Coupled with universities and lower cost of living, analysts say the growth is hardly surprising but certainly notable. Raleigh-Durham absolutely is playing a leading role in the dramatic growth in this industry, said Ian Anderson, CBRE's Director of Research and Analysis. If anything, its role is larger than what our report implies because our focus is more on human life sciences and, as such, overlooks some of the growth in crop and agricultural sciences that RDU excels in. How Carey Company's value went from $200 million to $800 million. When Craig Collard first took the reins as president and CEO of Veloxis Pharmaceuticals in 2015, he painted a picture to investors of cornering a steady patient market with an improved version of a generically available treatment. In the last 12 months, the company has nearly quadrupled in value as the strategic plan Collard set out comes into focus. Worth about $200 million at the start of 2018, Veloxis's market cap has hit nearly $800 million. The pharmaceutical company is centered around sales of its immunosuppressant, Enverus, spelled E-N-V-A-R-U-S. The drug, launched in 2015, is used for transplant patients to help keep their bodies from rejecting the new organ. The drug is currently approved for kidney patients in the U.S., Canada, and Europe. It is also approved for liver patients in Canada and Europe. Though technically headquartered in Copenhagen, one of Collard's first moves was dismantling its Denmark and New Jersey offices and transitioning operations to Cary. The company trades on the Copenhagen Exchange, and NASDAQ lists the stock under its Nordic group of companies. Collard says that transition took about a year to get everything running smoothly, but the company now has 58 employees, which Collard says meets the company's need, even in sales, as it expands. The reasoning behind that, Collard says, is the entire kidney transplant market in the U.S. is bottlenecked through about 200 transplant centers, each of which are now covered by his sales force of about 30. The beauty of this business is that we cover 100% of this market with 58 employees, he says. Collard says there are about 200,000 patients with a kidney transplant alive and about 20,000 new patients receiving a transplant each year. That $1.6 billion market is growing, according to Collard, at 4% per year. Once patients undergo a transplant, they are lifelong consumers of an immunosuppressant such as Enverus. In prior years, the company's drug only had approval for patients to convert to it after being prescribed other drugs following their procedure. In December 2018, the company received the labeling that allows it to be prescribed to new patients. And finally, in a section called He Said It, first, I want to highlight that this analysis has only increased our confidence in Doptelet, spelled D-O-P-T-E-L-E-T. Its significant market opportunity across multiple indications are, more importantly, the value it provides to patients. And more importantly, the value it provides to patients. That's from David Zaccardelli, Dova's new CEO, during an earnings call regarding a restructuring of the company's sales strategy that involved cutting 39% of its sales staff. And now we turn to the On Restaurants and Retail page, written by Dathan Kazuk. South American chefs highlight their native cuisine at event. Three local chefs teamed up with the City of Raleigh Museum for a special evening earlier this month as the museum celebrates Latino life in North Carolina in an exhibit called El Norte, Latino Life in North Carolina. The event brought together the traditions and fusion of food from Central and South America. Taking part were Chef Eli Rodriguez of SoCa, who represented El Salvadorian cuisine, Chef Angela Salamanca of Centro, and Gallo Pelon, who represented Mexico, and Chef Daniel Centeno of Escazu, spelled E-S-C-A-Z-U, chocolates, representing Venezuela. Here, the chefs explain the unique styles for the foods from each region. Rodriguez. While there are staple ingredients like tomatoes and chilies that you would find throughout Latin America, what makes the food from El Salvador unique is its history and how the ingredients come together. Once I started working in restaurants, I was working in more European-style kitchens, learning how to execute my craft. When I started working at SoCa, I was able to truly explore and elevate Salvadoran flavors. I get inspired by traditional dishes such as mariscada or pupas and playing with ingredients like morocco and azote. Centeno. While Latin American cuisine tends to have a lot of ingredients and flavors in common, there are always a few differences. For me, growing up with Colombian and Venezuelan foods, I can attest to how different they can be. A fascinating example that shows both the difference in regions and also the European influence is our traditional Christmas dish called jalaca. It is somewhat similar to a tamale, made using corn dough and wrapping it in plantain leaves. However, there is less dough and it is filled with a stew. How the stew is made varies by region. and by grandma. The most popular kind is the one from Caracas, where the stew is made with pork, beef, and hen. On the eastern side of the country, potatoes and hard-boiled eggs are added, while in the eastern coast and Margarita Island, the stew is made with fish. And Salamanca? Our dish is a combination of corn grits and pork shoulder, both basic southern flavor combinations with a few changes in the addition of cotija cheese, pineapple, and achiote, all traditional flavors of Mexico. Brewery ready to expand inside Raleigh Food Hall. Asheville's Burial Beer Company, which expanded into Raleigh earlier this year, is already looking to bulk up its space inside the Transfer Food Hall. On Facebook, Burial Beer posted, "Growth is a function of our environment and the nourishment we get from the crowd. It happened in Asheville, now it's happening in Raleigh." Burial has agreed to take on additional space that will link their exhibit space with the space of the newly announced Longleaf Swine Barbecue coming to the food hall. In the process, Burial will add new patio space, bathrooms, and direct linkage into the Transfer Food Hall. The food hall is already home to Locals Oyster Bar, Shea Empanadas, and the popular morning stop, Benchwarmers Bagels. Coming soon will be Videri Chocolate Factory, Choates, Bull Box, and Dank Burrito. Fashion retailer leaves downtown for North Hills. Another small retailer is leaving downtown Raleigh for a midtown location. Women's fashion retailer Voda Boutique is closing its Glenwood South shop and will move to the Lassiter District at North Hills. The shop plans to open in May. Located between the Spectacle and Kekel Avida Salon and Spa in North Hills, the boutique is known for clothing, jewelry, and accessories. "We're excited to welcome Voda Boutique," says Kane Realty CEO John Kane. "They offer both national and unique pieces from local artists. We're certain they will be successful in this location." Voda Boutique will reside in 1,200 square feet of space, which is slightly smaller than its downtown location. The retailer will sublease its current space to a local coffee shop that plans to open later this summer. Voda Boutique owner Kayla Brewer Cheek opened the store in June 2017 and says the shop's goal is to create a laid-back, stylish shopping experience where customers always feel welcome. "We're excited to move to North Hills and help even more shoppers with their style choices," she says. Cheek also is involved in several charitable events. Last November, she partnered with local vintage brand House of Landor to host a holiday fashion show. 10% of the sales from that event were donated to Project Catch, a local organization that raises funds and aims to serve the children in Wake County who are homeless. Voda is continuing to find new and exciting ways to connect with the community and looks forward to sharing more announcements soon, Cheek says. And finally, in a section called She Said It, it will be a blend of barrel-aged beer that's been aging for 2.5 years on cherries with a clean beer base and more cherries. And that's from Jennifer Kolaroff, co-owner of Noose River Brewing Company in Raleigh, on an upcoming Creek-style beer release. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page to first read the editor's notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, "Blue Cross Deal in Need of Much-Needed Ripple Effect." When one health insurance company controls more than 60% market share in one state, any action on corporate strategy should be closely followed by the people who buy insurance through their employers or through the government programs. On March 12, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina announced a pretty big deal to join forces with Oregon-based Cambia that would allow both companies to consolidate management, administrative, and other corporate services. That joint entity will have a new name, but Blue Cross will continue to use its prominent name in serving its 3.7 million customers in the state. Dr. Patrick Conway, the CEO of Blue Cross, sounded excited about the deal because he genuinely expressed concern about the rising health care costs being out of control. "For Blue Cross, it's all about paying out claims. That determines the insurance premiums everyone pays into the system. If an insurance company is paying out more in claims than it receives in premiums, it likely will go bankrupt eventually. Obviously, Blue Cross is far from that stage. The company earned $684 million last year. But things can change, and Conway, Cambia, and almost all health insurers across the country are trying to find a solution. Healthcare costs account for more than 20% of the country's gross domestic product, and that is going up almost every year. You ask doctors, hospital executives, insurers, and the government, and they all will agree on one thing. The rising costs in healthcare are unsustainable for a functioning economy. And yet, I'm not sure the stakeholders trust each other. They all want the other group to adjust the way it does business. For Conway and the folks at Cambia, now comes the test. Could this Blue Cross Cambia venture start the process of jump-starting the value-based care method from fee-for-service and then overlay disruptive technologies powered by artificial intelligence and blockchain? If Blue Cross and Cambia can control the supply chain costs and then get their large customer base to think differently, this could be a game changer for the industry. What's interesting is ventures such as these, if successful, may also force the hands of hospitals and doctors. The critical benchmark for any major corporate union is whether the savings find their way to the end user. In this particular case, it's the customer paying the premiums who need to see the savings. With Washington all over the place in terms of protecting or dismantling the Affordable Care Act's individual mandate, the slow and rising drumbeat of the progressives to embark on a Medicare for All strategy, and the disappearance of private physician groups from the healthcare ecosystem, insurance companies have their hands full. Reacting to change is often too late. One must be proactive. Blue Cross did just that this week. We will closely follow the outcome. And also on the Viewpoint page, we have a column written by John Hood, who is the chairman of the John Locke Foundation in Raleigh. The headline, Cooper Budget Uses Excessive Debt. American states and localities are, on the whole, administered more responsibly than is the federal government. Their superiority has nothing to do with the qualities of the individuals involved. Indeed, many federal politicians were once state or local politicians. The difference is institutional. It's about rules. Most states and localities are required to balance their operating budgets. The federal government isn't. Balanced budget rules, discipline, behavior, and choices of political actors. Compare the current conditions of the federal government and North Carolina state government. Washington is full of politicians who profess to care about fiscal responsibility, but do nothing of consequence about it. According to the latest estimates, we will see well over $10 trillion in federal deficits over the next decade. If President Donald Trump's recent budget proposal somehow became law, we'd still run $8 trillion in deficits during the period, and these scenarios assume no significant recessions. I think the recent federal tax bill was a good one. It reduced the double taxation of savings and investment, boosting both short-term and long-term economic growth. It also expanded the freedom of Americans by letting them keep and spend more of what they earned. But its fiscal impact should have been offset by large reductions in federal spending, both short-term and long-term. Although growth will be faster, broader, and deeper because of tax reform, the resulting increase in federal revenue will fall far short of closing the deficit. Tough decisions are inevitable. In North Carolina, by contrast, state government has run small to moderate surpluses every year since the end of the Great Recession. Its operating budget cannot, legally, run a deficit. Moreover, state lawmakers and governors have wisely chosen not to spend all the surpluses, but instead to build up the largest cash reserves in modern North Carolina history. These reserves came in handy when the hurricanes hit. They'll come in handy when the next economic recession hits. They will protect taxpayers by reducing the political pressure to raise taxes during future crises, as well as the state's long-term spending priorities. Fiscal panic is often inconsistent with sound budgeting. Balanced budget rules bind today's politicians in the interest of tomorrow's residents. These constraints can be uncomfortable. Leaders are compelled to make tough decisions. That produces better decisions and actually better leaders. The exceptions prove the rule. Consider two hot-button issues in North Carolina politics right now: Medicaid expansion and public debt. Governor Roy Cooper and legislative Democrats recognize that the state doesn't have nearly enough revenue coming in to finance the operating expenditures they believe are needed. But most also correctly believe that North Carolinians don't consider themselves undertaxed. Despite the forlorn hopes of progressive activists, Cooper was never going to propose large-scale tax increases on personal or corporate income. Instead, the governor's budget proposes to expand Medicaid and to issue $3.9 billion in bonds to fund capital projects for schools, colleges, universities, and local utilities. Both use borrowed money to skirt North Carolina's balanced budget rule, federal debt in the first case and state debt in the second. The Medicaid gambit is more egregious since Medicaid is inherently an operating expense. But even when it comes to capital spending, North Carolina has traditionally employed debt conservatively, not expansively. While borrowing does make financial sense in some cases, pay-as-you-go has its own benefits and ought to remain a significant part of the mix. More importantly, North Carolina has already been evading its balanced budget rule for decades by promising pension and retiree health benefits to public employees without setting aside enough money to cover the cost. We should have tightened the rule to stop that by requiring accrual rather than cash accounting. But we didn't, and now we have tens of billions of dollars in unfunded liabilities. That's a real debt that effectively reduces the state's capacity to issue bonds. Washington's unfunded liabilities are enormously larger, of course. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the small business section, where we read the Startup Voice column on Zookies Cookies, how Dog Treats Startup scored $50,000 investment on Shark Tank. And this is written by Lauren Onasorge. It's nerve-wracking being in the tank on national television, says serial entrepreneur Tom Simon. He, along with his business partner, Justin Miller, recently took a dive into ABC's Shark Tank, walking away with an investment from Dry Bar founder Ali Webb for their dog treat startup, Zookies Cookies. They describe a stressful experience, but one they do all over again, with or without the $50,000 investment they secured for 30% equity. It starts with a dramatic on-camera walk, Simon says. You walk into a space and see these well-known investors all looking back at you all at once, he explains. It's just quiet and everything starts moving fast. While it's just minutes on television, that's the editing magic, Simon and Miller describe at least an hour-long face-off where they talked ideas and numbers, much of which was left on the cutting room floor. It was much less formal than a boardroom pitch, Miller says. The Sharks aren't hosting your typical venture capital cattle call, something with which both Simon and Miller are innately familiar. Simon's last startup, Source 3, was acquired by Facebook, and Miller's last startup, WedPix, was scooped up by Mixbook. Both men have pitched before, prepping pitch decks and financial charts, but Shark Tank requires more than numbers. It requires a gimmick. We got the opportunity to do a really unique pitch, Simon says. Before announcing Zookies Cookies as a product aimed at pets, the pair manipulated the sharks into taking a bite of a dog treat, a stunt that, while risky, paid off in the form of added attention. It was just a real fun way to do things, Simon says. That was something that we had come up with early on when we were working with our production team on the pitch, something that was going to be a little bit different, and we based it on what we would do on a pop-up show. On pop-up shows, Miller says. We pitched it as being made with all things you and I would eat ourselves. Then they take a bite and say, oh my God. Following the gimmick is where the real work comes in, Miller says. Similar to a traditional pitch, it comes down to numbers, metrics, and customer acquisition costs. And experience with traditional VC pitching gave them a leg up, he says. But nothing prepares you for when the sharks start to drop out. An unnerving experience, Miller recalls. When the first person says they're out, you're like, oh crap, now I'm down to four. Now I'm down to three, he says. Eventually, it was down to Kevin O'Leary, also known as Mr. Wonderful, and Webb. O'Leary, Miller says, was not buying into the product at all. He was more pushing for us to potentially do something different, Miller says. It's tough to take money from someone who is telling us the business is going to fail. That, coupled with Webb's passion for animals, is what sealed the decision. Webb wanted to jump in there and really help us grow this thing, Miller says. Simon and Miller had wanted to be on the show all along, making it a goal for 2018, Simon says. It's the experience of a lifetime, he adds, and if you're hoping to get in the tank, he says you need to approach it that way. Approach it with the passion you have for the product in the first place. You're there because you love the product you created. Don't overthink it. You're here because of that passion, and just let that be your guide. Simon advises making sure your product works before approaching the sharks. Make sure you have some revenue to talk about and describe customer acquisition in your pitch. For example, they told the sharks they had $40,000 in sales in the first 9 months. A pack of more than six dozen cookies sells for $18.99. These guys are going to want to know if it sells, he says. If you have a product that you can sell in a creative way, I don't think there is any limitation to getting onto that show, Miller says. It's all about how to spin it and how to create something that would be interesting and enjoyable to watch from home. In the meantime, Zookie's Cookies is pumping out thousands of orders. Our first order from the show came in about 10 seconds after it started, Miller says. And he says the Webb investment is official. With her advice, the company has already overhauled its branding, even down to the font. It's pretty good for traction for a dog treat startup that really only began after Miller's 2017 exit. The pair have been friends for some time in their previous companies, having shared space in downtown Raleigh, and both were pet lovers. They'd call each other, alternating who brought which dog into work on a particular day to make sure all the canines would get along and not disrupt the office. Founding a company, particularly one about their shared animal interest, was a natural extension of their entrepreneurial friendship, they say. And in this same section, we'll read the column written by Edward Marshall, who is an adjunct professor in management at the Fuqua School of Business at Duke University. The headline, In Challenging Times, Being Honorable Requires Accountability. It seems to start early in life. My wife's second grade class has seen dishonorable behavior show up when a student lies to save face or manipulates to gain the favor of others. I see it among graduate students who plagiarize an article for a better grade or disrespect their teammates by not pulling their weight. We see dishonorable behavior in business, whether it is Retrofin's meteoric increase in the price of a life-saving drug, Wells Fargo's sales culture, which defrauded millions of customers, or Volkswagen's Dieselgate scandal. We are living in an era where the culture of deception, lying, and stealing is rampant. It is not okay. Why is this not met with righteous indignation? At West Point, the Cadet Honor Code is straightforward. A cadet will not lie, cheat, steal, or tolerate those who do. There is accountability for dishonorable conduct. In the Navy's Blue Angels, if you make a mistake while flying in excess of 700 miles per hour, you are expected to hold yourself accountable and never repeat that mistake. It could cost people their lives, and it has. In a collaborative workplace, honor is not only about integrity, but also about respecting the worth of every person. It's about transparency, fairness, and empowering people so they can do their best work and become their best selves. It is critical that we all assert the principles of being honorable with accountability in every aspect of our lives. Here are some guidelines. Model the way. Be clear about our own ethics and walk the talk. Take a stand. If we see dishonorable behavior, say something and do something. Be clear. Tell the truth about unethical conduct. A lie is a lie is a lie. Insist on accountability. If the individual will not hold themselves accountable, it is our responsibility to do so, even for what may seem to be minor infractions. And escalate if necessary. If the powers that be will not hold the individual accountable, escalate the dishonorable conduct to the next level within or outside the organization. Our honor is to be guarded carefully, especially within the culture of corruption evident across society today. As role models for our children and peers, it is our responsibility to be ethical leaders of consequence. And now in general news in the Triangle Business Journal. Rezoning request points to new townhomes. This article is written by Cliff Barnes. Parties working for a landowner are asking the city to change the zoning of parts of an 11-acre parcel of land in Raleigh. The land on Samuel Street needs rezoning to accommodate a new 80-unit townhome community. About 6 acres of the land at 800 Samuel Street are currently zoned for residential use, with the other 5 acres zoned for commercial mixed use. But TMTLA Associates of Durham and Summit Design and Engineering of Raleigh want the residential portion to be rezoned for neighborhood mixed use. About 50 of the 80 units would be on the land that is currently zoned for residential use. The land is in East Raleigh, not far from Raleigh Country Club. Prior to the official zoning request, neighbors who live within 500 feet of the property met and voiced concerns about increased traffic, removal of certain trees, and how the project could create a shortcut for apartment residents to walk through their property, potentially adversely affecting their property value. Pamela Porter of TMTLA and Donald Seaver of Summit Design, who are working on behalf of landowner Beverly Reitzel and family, say that the rezoned property would lead to a greater diversity of housing types and ensure the property would not be developed for incompatible uses adjacent to established residential neighborhoods. Plans are for the townhouses to be 2 stories and have either 2 or 3 bedrooms, and that there would be no further addition of townhomes and no commercial uses. The plans are under review by the city until March 21. Builder ramps up triangle homes for active aging population. This is also written by Cliff Barnes. A Maryland-based company with a large southeast footprint is looking to appeal to America's aging population by adding to its line of homes targeted at people age 55 and older in the Triangle. Dan Ryan Builders calls its communities designed for an older population. Elevate Homes already has a community in Clayton that is branded Forge Creek at Flowers Plantation. That location boasts a pool, clubhouse, fitness center, spa, and even a club bar, in addition to hiking and walking trails. The company plans to begin selling at Adeline Place this summer in Fuquay Arena. A formal opening is expected in September or October. The effort is designed to appeal to baby boomers who want the amenities of a community, but who are often downsizing from homes where they raise children. The prices also appeal to many who are retiring from other markets and can sell homes in northern metropolitan areas for double or triple the local prices, and then use their cash for travel or, if necessary, health care costs. Greensboro pitching district to attract new tourists. This article is from the Triad Business Journal. The Greensboro Science Center and the City of Greensboro will unveil this May a plan to transform 3 attractions north of town into a unified statewide travel and tourism destination. The Gateway Project will build upon the previous 10-year master plan by Executive Director Glenn Dobrogos and Assistant City Manager Chris Wilson, among others. Nowhere else in North Carolina will you find a location that includes an association of zoos and aquariums, accredited aquarium and zoo, an American Alliance of Museums, accredited science museum, a pivotal Revolutionary War battlefield, and a historic city park with a waterfront, Dobrogos said. With the center's attendance on the threshold of 500,000 visitors annually, and the hundreds of thousands of annual visitors to the adjacent parks, the opportunity for commercial revitalization along the corridor abounds. The 2020 to 2030 plan, dubbed the Gateway Project, the Art and Science of Imagination, calls for an immersive experience at the Science Center, a technology-infused linkage of the 3 parks, and significant construction and design along the Lawndale Drive corridor leading to the 400-acre destination. The Gateway moniker reflects the area's role as an entrance into the city, particularly as the northern sections of the Greensboro Urban Loop are slated to open in fall 2019 and late 2021. The project begins with a zoo expansion, with Samet Corporation doing the construction of the Lindsay architecture design. Beacon Partners closes on rest of warehouse portfolio, written by Ashley Fahey. Local real estate developer and investor Beacon Partners recently closed on the remainder of a warehouse portfolio that spans several submarkets in Charlotte, including some near the transit line. Beacon acquired multiple buildings at the end of February, 1411 and 1419 Amarin Drive off North Graham Street, 4324 Behringer Drive off Clanton Road, and two properties in Lower South End, 209 to 217 Southside Drive, which includes Sugar Creek Brewing Company as a tenant. Beacon paid a total of $7.1 million for the second part of the portfolio, bringing the entire deal to about $20.3 million for 266,359 square feet of space. The portfolio, which also included two other properties on Amarin Drive, two in Southwest Charlotte, and six about a block from the Lynx Blue Line Scaly Bark Station, was sold by Vincent Enterprises Incorporated. The first half closed in January. Pete Kidwell, Director of Industrial Investments at Beacon, previously said some of the buildings would be retained as warehouses, while others, namely the ones near the Blue Line, which total about 50,000 square feet, would be converted into office and retail space. Those buildings on Dewitt Lane and Triclin Drive are adjacent to a new development Beacon has in the works that, at build-out, will include space for offices, retailers, and restaurants, in addition to apartments and a boutique hotel, though that project is separate from the adaptive reuse plans. Supply is shrinking even more and more, so we're seeing a lot of that industrial property on North Davidson and South End getting retrofitted or structures are torn down altogether, Kidwell said at the time, adding that rising construction costs and interest rates have also put pressure on the cost of building new, which is in part driving the adaptive reuse trend. Beacon Partners recently filed to rezone the Dewitt Lane and Triclin Drive buildings from I-2 General Industrial to TOD-M Transit-Oriented Development Mixed Use, which allows a range of commercial uses. And that article was from the Charlotte Business Journal. And finally, the Business Survey Pulse. Do you agree with RDU's decision to approve the Wake Stone Quarry lease? 1,678 responses, 74% no, 26% yes. And we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time, and if you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138.